the joint ways and means to order and open the public hearing for Senate Bill 5501, Department of Agriculture. Katie, would you like to continue?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
As Ms. Kova sits down and gets organized, may I ask a threshold question?
Sure.
Ms. Kova, you got any chairs on order?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, not to my knowledge, and we are meeting with our administrative staff tomorrow morning to make sure we don't have
the for the record.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Director of Department of Agriculture.
Okay, thanks. You started out on a tough day already.
She took me on, Mr. Chair, and I hadn't even bought a chair.
Well, what did you confess to those hard hats?
Okay, I think we're ready, but you never know for sure.
Exactly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, again. Katie Kova, Director of the Department of Agriculture. For today, what we thought we would do is begin going through our policy areas, and we wanted to start off. You can refer to page 4 in your budget book, the organizational structure. We wanted to start off with Chuck Craig, the deputy, going over the natural resources policy area. So that will include an overview of the plant division, the natural resources division, and our animal health and identification division. What we're hopeful is that we can get through that policy area today and also start out on the food safety and consumer protection policy area, and have Lisa Hansen give an overview of the food safety division, the pesticides division, measurement standards, as well as commodity inspection division. So, aggressive agenda for you today. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Chuck.
I think that Mr. Chair was a not so subtle message that we should just all stay in line today.
Well, I would like to, as we did last Thursday, let's try to hold our questions until we get through each section.
Mr. Chair, would they please tell us which publication?
Yes.
We got about 5 or 6 papers.
Are we in this book right now?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Chuck Craig, deputy with Ag. We've got our own presentation here that's a high-level overview to try to give you an appreciation for the things we do and what we've accomplished. And
do they have copies of this?
So you have a handout that's that.
Good.
Mr. Chair, can we just give it to
Yes.
I can't tell from your titles where it's stuffed, but when somebody gets to the area that covers the shellfish inspection program, would they give us also some detail on both the commercial and the non-commercial sides? I know that there are shortfalls there, but I keep getting lost. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, that primarily is in our food safety division. There is a part of the shellfish program in natural resources that has to do with leasing the plats, but it doesn't inspect for food safety. Okay. Mr. Chair, the natural resources division is the one I'll lead off with. It's a little over half general funded, has lottery funds connected with the Oregon plan, significant fee revenues in the fuel burning program, as well as some program funds that show up as other funds that are transfers from other agencies, such as 319 funds that originate from EPA but come through DEQ and so on, and a few other miscellaneous sources, and then a small amount of federal funds. Its overall purpose is to conserve and protect and develop the natural resources of the state so agriculture will continue to be productive and economically viable. It has several significant programs. The fuel burning program manages agricultural fuel burning in the Willamette Valley to maintain that as an agronomic tool for Oregon's grass seed industry, which, as many of you know, Oregon is the leader in the nation in terms of production of cool season grass seeds. We also provide the weather forecasting services for fuel burning in other parts of the state, which include Jefferson County and Union County areas. And then finally, we partner with the Oregon seed industry in a research and development program that is aimed at continually improving cultural practices for production of grass seed without burning that enable our industry to remain competitive and profitable. We also house the confined animal feeding operations program in that division, which is designed to prevent water pollution from livestock operations and maintain federal acceptance for that program. The Soil and Water Conservation District program, which I know many of you are familiar with, we are the state agency with leadership responsibility for that program. We coordinate the Soil and Water Conservation Commission and provide assistance and oversight to the Soil and Water Districts. We also track land use issues of significance to agriculture sort of rather assiduously and are always on the lookout for things that may be happening that could be detrimental to agriculture. And for instance, we will have people that will testify as expert witnesses on right to farm in nuisance cases where a landowner has taken a neighbor to court and complained about a farming practice. And also the Senate Bill 1010 agricultural water program is in that division. The plant conservation biology program, which we talked about a little bit in our earlier session, that studies and lists and conserves threatened and endangered plants is there. And we also manage the leasing of shellfish production, commercial shellfish production plats on state-owned estuary lands in that division. This is a little bit more detail on the overall funding structure for the division. There are about 39 FTE and 45 positions, and overall those are almost half field-oriented positions and half positions that work out of the office in Salem. Some of the things that we've accomplished in the division, we have finished 30 Senate Bill 1010 plans now, and there are 9 left to do. They will be done by the end of 2004. You saw this map earlier. It's only the pink areas that are left to do. We distributed $3.8 million to the Soil and Water Districts for administrative assistance, support as local management agencies. They operate as our local management agency for Senate Bill 1010 plans, and general outreach and technical assistance to landowners. In cooperation with the SWCDs, we have provided educational outreach to ag and rural landowners, done a great deal of administrative assistance to local advisory committees, water quality monitoring, and we've also got a project going on to establish with OACD, the Association of Conservation Districts, a scientific way for establishing riparian site capability. This slide shows the just incredible job that the Soil and Water Conservation Districts are doing in landowner outreach. The thousands of landowners that they're contacting, the outreach activities, there are actually workshops. And you can see, obviously, one bottleneck in this slide in terms of farm plans complete. It has a lot to do with the actual technical assistance provision that is available. We also have established a statewide coordinator for the conservation, the Enhanced Conservation Reserve Program, which is a Farm Bill program that provides incentive payments for landowners to enroll sensitive riparian lands in conservation programs. And with the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts, we did a statewide review of the factors that were limiting participation in that program, and then OEB has funded us to do a statewide coordination effort to improve the participation there.
Chuck, if I might break in here, and I'm not sure this is going to be possible for you today, but I think it would be very helpful when we're considering the situation we have with 0103 as well as the 0305 budgets, is after, as you're bringing up and explaining these different programs, you can tell us how much is, how they're funded, and how much is general fund, and how much is supposed to be other and federal funds. Because we're going to have to get to that point sooner or later. Now, I'm not asking you to make a big deal of it, but just as you're going through each program, identify those funding sources.
Mr. Chairman, Katie Koba, we have submitted to you our prioritized list that the committee asked
That's
from all agencies.
List, right?
And it lists each program, and it lists then the funding sources. So yep. That is available to
we
the committee.
That. I've got it here.
Yep.
And that will cover even the breakdowns within the department?
That list is provided program by program. Right. So, for example, you've got the Healthy Streams Oregon Plan, you've got Confined Animal Feeding Operations, you've got Soil and Water Districts, got quite a few of them. And certainly if there are things in here that you want clarification about, we can do that.
I guess that's what I was referring to, that inside of those programs, there's different dedicated funds, I would imagine, to where those funds have to go. Or are you pretty open? Program basis.
Mr. Chair, at the program level, if there are other funds, they are typically dedicated legislatively to the purpose of that program. So the fuel burning program, for example, those fees are dedicated to the administration and operation of the fuel burning program.
Same for federal funds?
Federal funds may be earmarked by the program that they came from, but they're not from biennium to biennium. The sources of federal funding can change, but at any one point in time, when we get federal funds, we typically have a contract with the federal government that says what we will spend that money for, and we really can't use it for something else. Mr. Chair, continuing, we are well along on implementing the expanded confined animal feeding operations program, nearly have the federally acceptable permit developed and should be adopting that soon. And we also, once again, this past year operated the Willamette Valley fuel burning program in support of the grass seed industry, which is a substantial challenge every year to get that done. This shows that we have established six field people in the CAFO program, each with his own territory. We have very high caliber field people in that program now who are able to get along well with the landowners, and we've gotten very nice compliments from the industry on the ability of our folks now to work with livestock owners, and that's going quite well. And this is Jim Little, who you may recognize as was KOIN's chief meteorologist, is now the forecaster for our field burning program and also provides forecast services for other department activities such as pesticide applications and eradication efforts and so forth. The next division in the natural resources cluster is the Animal Health and Identification Division. Largely other funds from the brand inspections and from a...
Let me check. Let's back up and ask a question while we're on natural resources. Any questions of the committee on natural resources?
I had a question.
Sunday morning.
On how many permitted sites are there relating to CAFO? Do you have a ballpark number?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, there currently are about 500 permitted CAFOs that are predominantly dairies. And However, the federal regulations require that another part of the universe of livestock operations that been referred to AFO-CAFOs, but they're livestock operations that have certain characteristics also need to be permitted under federal law. And last session of the legislature, passed Bill 2156 that gave the department the authority to perform the function of regulating those entities as well. And we are thinking that there probably will be at least a 50% increase in the number of permitted CAFOs as the result of implementing that law. We've been in the process of developing an inventory and checking the operations that are out there to see if they are federal CAFOs or not and would require a permit. But that's going to take us probably a couple of years.
Representative Morgan.
Can you talk to me a little bit about where the line is that would get somebody into a CAFO inspection situation rather than just staying as an AFO?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the federal system is different, very different than what the state had as far as determining when an operation needed a permit. Under the federal system, it's a three-tiered system. And if you've got over, and I'm going to use animal units, even though they've moved away from 1,000-pound animal units and now specify exactly the number of animals of each species that it requires to have a permit in the new regs, but for the purposes of discussion here, it's easier to use that. You have over 1,000 animal units, and you are a so-called animal feeding operation, which means that you can find for more than 45 days on a surface that is devoid of vegetation. You become a CAFO in the federal system, and you need a permit. So if you're over 1,000 animal units and you have the situation on the surface with concentrated animals on a bare surface, you need a permit. If you're between 300 and 700, or between 300 and 1,000 animal units, which the lower limit of 300 is about 200 dairy cows or 300 range cattle, whether you need a permit or not depends also on whether there is a potential for pollution to occur either because of discharge through a man-made conveyance, such as you've got a waste containment facility that can overflow or an irrigation system to put manure out on pasture or cropland, or if the waters of the United States originate outside your operation, flow through it, and the animals have direct contact with the water within the so-called production area of the facility, which is the bare surface part of the facility. If you meet those requirements.
So in the situation you're describing, you would only be talking about the area where you actually fed the cows, or would you be talking about the pastures?
No. If you have a combination of a production area, which is the bare area with concentrate where the animals are concentrated, they're fed, and there's concentrated amounts of manure potentially present, pasture land is separate from that.
Okay.
And has separate requirements that apply to it. And you can have as much pasture land as you want, not necessarily be a CAFO.
So the bottom end, from a point of view of how many head you have, though, is 300?
300 animal 300? Units translates into 200 dairy cows, 300 cow-calf pairs. There are conversion factors for poultry and horses and all other species of commercial livestock, emus, whatever it is. You can look it up and see how many animals it takes to get you into that category.
And is there a CAFO requirement if you're under that threshold?
There can be. There isn't necessarily. If you're under that threshold, then you can become a CAFO if you're designated as a significant contributor. And that's a process that follows a specified sort of protocol with a site visit required, and it's intended really to be reserved either for an extraordinarily recalcitrant small operation or something that just by its nature can cause a severe watershed impact. And this is actually an area that we probably will have more to discuss about, the interplay between Senate Bill 1010 and CAFO, is the interface here between small livestock operations and Senate Bill 1010.
Thank you.
Chuck, I want to pursue that a little further. Last session, when we were having the discussions with EPA and trying to define how we're going to deal with this whole CAFO issue, I discussed with, I can't remember the guy's name from EPA who came down several times, what this really meant. And my concern was that if they were concerned about what was going on in eastern Oregon with their very low rainfall, when they hit the west coast or the Willamette Valley west of the Cascades, we're out of business. Verbally, he told me that they were not interested in that. And my question is, have they defined that? Is that anything in black and white, or what you just described, is that kind of what you've verbally negotiated, or you know, exactly where are we? Because the problem in my mind is the uncertainty is absolutely huge, and we need to put this in some kind of administrative rule or language so that we can manage, the operators can manage with some certainty.
Mr. Chair, we're negotiating with them from both a policy and a work plan standpoint how we would deal with those kind of operations. I see no evidence that they have changed direction on the general question you've posed.
But it's, we don't know for certain what I'm hearing you say.
Well, we haven't gotten through the process and been delegated and so on, and that's the proof of the pudding. So,
I've got two or three more questions. You mentioned there's 45 soil and water districts. Has there been any effort to combine some of those districts? That's been talked about for a long time, and as we get into financial straits here, I think that's going to be more pertinent.
Mr. Chair, yes. Over the years, we've brought the subject up. And it's usually met without much interest. And as you know, Baker County, for instance, has four districts in the county. Lane County has two.
Douglas County has at least two.
Douglas County has two. There are several counties that have more than one soil and water district, and we've advanced the notion of how about one district per county. Multnomah has two, so but we've not gotten had a lot of success in convincing people.
Are any of those counties considering at this time combining, or is it still just something they don't want to deal with?
I can't say for sure, Mr. Chair. I think we'd have to talk to the program manager in that area to find out if he knows if there's an active discussion going on with any of them.
Second question, in the shellfish leasing of Division of State Lands properties, I assume that's who owns it or who has title to it. Could you give us some background as to why the Department of Ag is managing those shellfish leases? And then let me tell you where I'm coming from. As we're looking for general fund monies, and I'm sure you have to manage this with general fund monies, I would guess, the Division of State Lands does not use general funds. And so why are we using general fund monies if we are to manage for that?
Mr. Chair, we are not using general fund to manage it. The oyster growers that lease those lands pay fees, and I think it's $4 an acre for the plats, and then there's a fee, 10 cents a gallon or something like that, on the oysters or the clams or whatever. So it's a completely other funded program. It started out in originally, I think it was in Department of Fish and Wildlife, and then it went to state lands, and it eventually came to us. And that was way before my time, but we ended up with it, and it stayed here for quite some time.
Well, ask.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chair, if you're thinking about the general fund that has to do with the shellfish inspections,
that's different.
Okay, yeah, that is in a different program.
Well, last question. Gets back to what I talked about, where the funds are coming from. You mentioned on our sheet here that KDU had a priority, yes, smoke management. But when you were talking about field burning and the Eastern Oregon weather forecasting and all those, I'm guessing those are different types of funds that do those different functions. And so, is there a field burning program and a smoke management program, or are they all one?
No, Mr. Chair, they're all one program.
So you mentioned the Willamette Valley, but then you also mentioned the program in Eastern Oregon. Are they funded separately?
No, Mr. Chair, the growers in Eastern Oregon pay a fee to the field burning program as well, but it's only $4 an acre versus the $8 an acre that the Willamette Valley growers pay, and we provide weather forecast services to them as part of the fee-based services.
That's all other funds?
Yes, that's correct.
Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Krieger? Chuck, a lot of what you deal with is water, with CAFOs and stuff. I take a look, you know, you work with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Department of Forestry, and DEQ, and then you throw in OWEB, Soil Water Conservation Districts, 10-10, Watershed Councils. How do you get away from, is there some duplication going on? All those people are taking part in monitoring. I'm willing to bet you that somewhere you've got a temperature gauge in the Department of Forestry, 10 feet away you've got one from Ag, or you've got one from someone else. They don't even know they're there. Do you know if there's any way that's being coordinated, that you use each other's science and information in some manner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I can't say for sure that there's not some duplication going on, but I think the Soil and Water Conservation Districts do know, by and large, what is going on in their area. Whether or not they raise objections and try to prevent duplication or not, I don't know, but we certainly try in the monitoring that we have districts cooperate with districts in, we try to avoid duplication, but I would really have to research that and get back to you on it. I just don't think I can do justice to the subject off the cuff here. So
I would just, Mr. Chair, suspect that with as many different entities as you have out there doing different things, that there's probably some savings that could be made in that area.
I think, Representative, that's a very good question, because the makeup and the relationship between soil and water districts and watershed councils and watershed associations varies throughout the state. As you know, in Curry County, they work very closely together. Others I know don't work closely at all together. So,
and Mr. Chair, sometimes there's that turf protection.
That's right.
Yeah, that happens.
Yes, Senator Dukes.
Go back to the oyster leasing. That's got to be submerged in submersible lands, that at least in some way or another falls under the purview of the Division of State Lands, at least, I guess, ownership to the state of Oregon, and could be likened to other submerged and submersible lands. Now, the operation is actual, I mean, the oversight is actually paid for by the folks themselves. Do they also, I mean, I know they pay a leasing fee. Where does that go?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, the lease fee goes to the Department of Agriculture for administering
that
program.
That's part
of
it as well. Yeah. It's interesting that it's so much different. I mean, if you have a business, oh my, I can think of it as the Columbia River, but it could be any place. You pay a leasing fee, and that's all you pay, no matter what. I mean, you may be generating revenues from being able to lease that land, but you're not paying a percentage of those revenues as well. Probably six or one half dozen of the other. Do they pay a lower leasing fee than other submerged and submersible lands?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, offhand, I don't know if other public lands that are submersed and submersible, what the rates are, because there are, you know, county and court lands potentially that could be leased for shellfish production, and there also are a small amount of private lands that ownership existed to prior to statehood, but I really don't know what the lease rates might be on those lands.
The DSL has an extensive lease program and leases those lands, and they've tried over recent times to standardize those leases. So perhaps they don't bear a relationship to the others? I guess as long as it all comes out in the wash, it's fine. But it surprises me that they're not.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a direct relationship at all.
If I could maybe ask you a little different, Senator. What you're saying, Chuck, is that there's no fund from these leases that goes to the state school fund?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
That's always interesting.
Mr. Chairman, I might add, you know, there's a lot of discussion going on about the Measure 66 monies and the fact that they get distributed to a number of different state agencies. My recommendation to this committee is to maybe spend a day or so just reviewing Measure 66 dollars. You know, it's difficult for us to sit here and talk about how those monies work in other state agency budgets. And I certainly couldn't sit here and give you a recommendation about how those dollars should be dispersed. And I think it would behoove the committee to take kind of just a look at that piece all by itself and where the dollars go and how they're spent.
Thank you. We will be spending some time when we deal with over it. Thank you. They do administer those funds. So probably spend a lot of time turning that apart.
Mr. Chair, I was going to say, there's how many agencies? Are there about five of them or something that get Measure 66?
Probably. Any other questions? All right, Chair.
Mr. Chair, moving along to the Animal Health and Livestock ID Division. This division has a lot of other fund. About a fifth general fund. The other funds come from brand inspection fees and principally from a fee on veterinary remedies called the veterinary product registration fee that was really implemented 10 to 12 years ago and a small amount of federal funds. This division tries to produce an environment in which human health is protected and the economic production of livestock is protected. Does that through the veterinary health program by controlling and eradicating animal diseases with special concern for those that are transmissible to humans, and a number of serious animal diseases do cross over to humans. We also deter the theft of livestock through the brand program and ensure animal food safety and consumer protection through the feeds program. The programs in the division break down according to animal health, which are the four state veterinarians that are on constant alert for the incursion of dangerous or destructive livestock diseases into the state. And they also work with the livestock production industries to develop management and prevention programs for diseases. The livestock...
And I might add, Mr. Chairman, both in the animal health program and the food safety program, we're involved in homeland security with those programs because there is a concern that that could be a target for terrorism activities.
Terrorism. Yes. Mr. Chair, I just didn't hear you, Ms. Kova. Terrorism?
Terrorism.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll expand on that a little bit in a minute. Livestock ID deters theft and investigates incidents of suspected livestock theft, and we'll talk about that a little bit. Feeds program inspects samples and analyzes feeds to make sure that the contents comply with the label and that the feeds don't contain harmful or banned substances, and also inspects Oregon feed mills to prevent mad cow disease. Under FDA protocols, we inspect the feed mills to assure that the ruminant-to-ruminant feed ban is actually being practiced. There's a small program that permits exotic animals, which are bears, wolves, the large cats, and non-human primates that are held by private citizens as pets, and that's for safety of the public as well as the welfare of the animals. And then the predator control program is one in which we principally we pass through legislative funding to USDA Wildlife Services to support their control programs, which is a cooperative agreement-based program between the state, federal government, and the counties, with, of course, the landowners. Again, there are total of 37 FTE here, 104 positions. 72 of those positions are seasonal brand inspector positions. So there's a very large complement of part-time field people there. Some of the things that this division has accomplished, inspected over 1.1 million cattle. And actually 14 or 15,000 horses in 25,000 separate inspections. It's worked with the dairy, poultry, and beef industry to help implement programs for prevention of Yoni's disease in dairy cattle, trichomoniasis in beef cattle, and a variety of poultry production disease problems. And this past year, we had a threat to our tuberculosis-free status. There was a captive farmed elk herd that one of the animals had tuberculosis, and this we had to depopulate that herd and also deal with other cattle in the surrounding area that may have come in contact with that. We were able to do that and prevent any spread of tuberculosis out of that area. The reason that is important is because if we lose our free status for TB, brucellosis, or pseudo-rabies, the cost and complexity to livestock owners to move their cattle out of state becomes a big deal. They have to be tested, and there's a lot of rigmarole to go through to export your cattle, and it's very worthwhile not to be to have free status for TB or brucellosis. In the homeland security area, we have substantially improved our capacity to deal with a deliberate terrorist, eco-terrorist, agro-terrorist outbreak, or an incidental incursion of an emergency animal disease. We've done that with the help of federal Homeland Security funds, but we have new equipment, we have advanced training that we've put our staff through. We have done a lot of outreach effort and training for the people that we collaborate with, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the distinct possibilities here in a minute. But for example, we have a trailer system. It's been loosely referred to as the trailer of death, but we have a trailer system with all the items necessary in it to respond to an outbreak of a foreign animal disease somewhere in the state within the matter of a few hours. Our staff can be on scene and doing what is necessary to control the situation there. And that has been copied all over the nation now. Washington has two of them, and we keep getting reports that neighboring states are buying more of these things. So that's one thing. We've also equipped all of our veterinarians with digital cameras, laptop computers, and the software capacity. If they see something they're not sure about, they can immediately consult with the leading diagnosticians worldwide on what they see and find out, is this what we think it is? Do we have to act now on this? We have also sent our staff to places like England in the foot and mouth disease outbreak to work there with the local veterinarians and public health officials so that they have had actual field experience when these things happen. One of our vets just came back from California who was there on the exotic Newcastle disease outbreak. And finally, we've done a considerable amount of outreach and education efforts on West Nile virus recently. We investigated and supported the prosecution of two major livestock theft cases. These were really high-profile cases where we were able to put together the evidence that in one case is convicted, in the other case it now is indicted, people that have been apparently involved in the theft of hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of livestock from owners. And this has, in fact, we can tell from the number of contacts that we get from cattle owners that are about suspected cases of livestock theft, we can tell this program is really having a deterrent effect. We initiated our BSE prevention and inspection program at Oregon feed mills and also began an educational outreach program for the mills. We have kind of a self-help checklist that they can actually manage their operations and refer to that to be sure. On the subject of homeland security, foot and mouth disease is regarded both by us and the federal government as one of the possibilities for agroterrorism that has the highest potential of happening in the United States. If someone wanted to disrupt our economy, this would be relatively easy and feasible thing to do. There was, in the past couple years, an incidental outbreak in the United Kingdom of foot and mouth disease, which is a hot virus disease of cloven hoof animals that spreads very rapidly between swine, cattle, and sheep. What happened in the UK in this outbreak, there was $20 billion cost. All aspects of the economy were affected. The social and economic impacts were unbelievable. There were people who could not leave their homes, kids who couldn't go to school for a month because of this. They were essentially quarantined to their own home. serious ripple effects through the economy, number of environmental impacts, cost in the U.S. is figured at $10 billion minimum, and this actually, the incident in the U.K. destabilized the country politically. The threat is taken so seriously that just last week the federal government held an exercise in Kansas. It's called Silent Prairie. The Surgeon General, Deputy Secretaries of Agriculture, and a number of other people came together in a simulated exercise on what would happen if there was a foot and mouth disease outbreak in the U.S. These things are becoming more and more of a threat. We see more and more exotic diseases. As I mentioned, they're in the exact analogy in poultry, exotic Newcastle's disease, is in epidemic proportions in the southwest United States right now. And it's causing millions of dollars of damage a day to the poultry industry there. Mentioned the livestock theft cases. We have two livestock police officers on our staff. They're retired OSP people. One's Roy Hyder, which many people know is retired chief of the Fish and Wildlife Division of the State Police, and also another gentleman by the name of Bob Lund, who is an investigator, also retired OSP guy. Bob Lund, we were told by the district attorney in Union County that the case that he prepared for them was the most complex case that he had ever tried in 20 years. There were over 4,000 pieces of evidence introduced, and the trial took 2 weeks. So,
Mr. Chair. I know you asked us to hold our questions, but I got to ask this one so I can understand the context that it's in. Why are you doing this and not OSP?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, in effect, what's happened over the years is that the traditional law enforcement agencies have kind of lost contact with livestock issues. And so in order... And they support us very strongly. It's not as if they're not involved, but the expertise that's necessary to bring these cases forward and actually make them stick and get a conviction really depends on our folks and working, you know, on the detailed issues involved, as opposed to asking OSP or someone else to spare someone to do that in where they don't have as much expertise as they used to and where they're preoccupied with other problems. And so we provide that linkage and expertise.
If I might expand on that, if any, there's two different situations, actually. There's livestock that's being transported down the road, and there's also the checkpoints at the point of sales, at weigh stations or auction yards or wherever. And the state police do check on the highways periodically, but this is a more of a specialized service or responsibility, I should say, where they are literally at every point of change of ownership.
One other question, Mr. Chair, to show my blinding ignorance of these issues. And I come from cowboy country. A member of my family owns a brand. With all of the technology now where I see on the TV that you can go down and have a little chip put in your cat or your dog that has all kinds of information on it, is branding and tracing the brands a little anachronistic at this point?
Mr. Chair, Rep. Johnson, I think...
I see the cattleman smiling. I think
we have a tendency to think that the days are numbered because the technology is coming, but it isn't here and it isn't completely accepted yet. But I think the tendency is to move to a more and more technological basis. Chips, DNA testing, all those sort of things will eventually change the system.
We've got one more slide, and then we'll ask questions again.
Mr. Chair, this sighting is rumored by some to be a behavior modification experiment being conducted by Wildlife Services, or a new GMO coyote that's been introduced to dilute the gene pool, but I thought I would close with a little humor.
Chuck, I got to say, you know, we can't see this very well.
Oh.
I was trying to hurry you along to see if that was right. Yeah.
The magic of
the yeah, I do have a couple of questions that we'll open up for the committee. When the livestock division, particularly in the change of ownership, what types of livestock are checked? And are sheep, horses? It's been a while since I was in this part of the
Mr.
business.
Chair.
And we've got llamas and everything else now.
Yeah, cattle and horses are required to be checked.
But if there's a theft, you also send your people out to do research on those. And the question is, are those other types of livestock paying their share of when there's a need for investigation?
Probably not if they don't pay into the brand program, but if there's a case where somebody's livestock's been stolen, we'll try to help them.
Second question, I noticed in the governor's budget the predation funding is totally removed from the general fund. Could you give us an indication of what impact that will have on the programs at the county level?
Mr. Chair, that's about what it adds up to, as I recall. It's roughly in the 15% to 20% of the total on the ground funding that comes down at the county level between what Wildlife Services put in, what the state puts in, and what the counties put in.
Would you expect that some programs are going to stop, fall off, just because they won't be able to maintain?
Mr. Chair, I would not be surprised. There are 24 counties, I think, now that participate in the program.
It would be helpful if you could bring us some information back, maybe poll some of the county programs or talk to the federal government and see how many programs will not be sustainable without this general fund funding.
Okay.
Any other question from the committee on this segment? Thank you. Move on. Might add, we're on page 9. We've got 25, and we're over halfway through the committee.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to keep the...
And we'll try to contain ourselves there.
I'm just going to say, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, the plant division of the department is another rather diverse division. It gets some general fund, somewhat less than a third. It gets federal funding largely from USDA for eradication efforts and through the federal-state cooperative agreements. It also gets funds from the nursery and Christmas tree growers that are the result of licensing and inspection fees of various kinds. And the weed program gets some lottery funds that it uses both for active control efforts as well as passing on funds to the local level through the state weed board. Purpose of this division is to protect both Oregon's agricultural industries and the natural environment of the state as a whole from invasive plants, diseases, noxious weeds, while maintaining our reputation for high-quality, pest-free agricultural products. There are a number of significant programs in this division. The insect pest prevention program, one of the best known because of its work on the gypsy moth and similar pests, and there's also a plant health program or plant pathology program, I guess, depending on whether you're an optimist or a pessimist. And both of these programs work in fairly similar ways. They detect, survey, and so forth, and then control and eradicate plant pests and diseases. They try to do that as much as possible on a preventative basis rather than waiting until something is very widespread and expensive to control. And this division also is involved in homeland security activities in terms of maintaining awareness and capacity to identify threats to the food supply that might come through the cropping system. The nursery and Christmas tree program is a very important one. It provides inspection and certification services for nursery stock and Christmas trees that allow them to be shipped out of state. And the noxious weed program, the department is the state's lead agency for noxious weed control efforts. We conduct surveys and detect the incursion of noxious weeds, keep pretty good records on the status of different weeds. We assist other state and federal agencies. We're a national leader in the application of biocontrols to control noxious weeds. And we also, as I mentioned before, provide grant funds to local weed boards and other organizations through the state weed board. This division has 120 positions and 73.5 FTE. A large number of those positions are seasonal trappers. Within the office, there are roughly 45 people at the program level, and they're split about half between field people and professionals that actually work in the Salem office. Some of the things that the program has done, placed 25,000 traps statewide to survey for 20 high-risk insect species. We've eradicated additional small gypsy moth infestations that we keep finding, small ones. You saw the slide in our first session of the radical decrease in the number of gypsy moths that are detected, but nevertheless they still are found in Oregon. We have another infestation in southeast Lincoln County that we're going to have to try to eradicate, and most people are familiar with the severe impact that this pest can have on vegetation. We also this past year found a dozen Japanese beetles in the area south of the air freight terminal at Portland International Airport. I need not tell anyone that's been in the Midwest what kind of havoc this could cause to Oregon crops and to our environment if it got loose. And we have treated a very large area south of the airport with foliar and turf sprays to try to make sure that none of these things survive. We contain sudden oak death, we hope, to the quarantine area in Curry County. We've cut and burned 52 acres worth of diseased trees and shrubs. We have Representative Krieger brought this up, and I wanted to expand on it a little bit. When the outbreak occurred and when we began to understand that other states and other countries were very concerned about this, we initiated a sampling program and surveyed our commercial nurseries and Christmas tree plantations for the existence of the pathogens of this disease, and found that they were free of it. And Christmas a year ago, the Canadian government imposed quarantine on the movement of nursery stock out of areas that had sudden oak death. And that was right at the time when the Oregon nursery industry was getting ready to ship their ornamental azaleas for the Christmas season. And so there was millions of dollars worth of ornamental azaleas ready to be shipped. And the Canadians, who are our largest trading partner, were telling us we're going to quarantine you and that stuff can't come in. Because we had done this testing program, we were able to convince them not to do that to us. And so this program is extremely important to the largest sector of the agriculture economy in Oregon right now. A few other things, we found a couple of very serious invasive species recently. Kudzu found in three sites in the Willamette Valley. I don't know how many people are familiar with it. It is an incredibly aggressive invasive vine. It's called the Scourge of the South. This is the first time it's been found west of Texas, but it showed up in Clackamas County. See how tall it is. It basically grows up the trees and smothers them out. The lower picture is actually the site a year after it was sprayed, and you can see it's dying. But the point I want to make here is we've got some things like Scotch broom that's estimated to cost something like $40 million to Oregon landowners to deal with. Both kudzu and some of the other things that we've found, like giant hogweed is another one I'll mention, these are capable of being problems of the same magnitude as Scotch broom. Giant hogweed is a poisonous plant that we found in parts of Lane and Douglas County. There are now 70 sites on which it's occurring. We think we've got a good inventory and we've got it controlled before it spreads to the point where conventional methods can't be used. But people noticed that they got blisters every time they went out and tried to deal with this, but they didn't know why, because no one had identified this plant yet and informed them as to what would happen if they got the sap from it on their skin. Another very significant problem, more of an east side riparian area, invasive purple loosestrife. We have released some biological controls for this, which are showing great promise now, and it looks like this one may be headed for good control. We've partnered with USDA on Homeland Security. I mentioned that. And then finally, this division is the home in the Agency for the Invasive Species Council, which was created legislatively last session. And we, with the help of our three other agency partners, which are Department of Fish and Wildlife, Oregon State University, and Portland State University, we have that up and running, and it is accomplished substantially what it was asked to do in its early stages.
Okay, Chuck, let's go to questions on this. Yes,
on invasive species, two questions. One had never occurred to me until I was looking at your presentation. We argue about ballast water and all that sort of stuff here for waterborne craft. But when you mention something, an invasive species being so close to the Portland airport, caused me to wonder, do we have an inspection program for airplanes?
We do, and we actually, we have traps set up around the high-risk areas also, but the... In some ways, the program's only as good as the prevention that's going on the other end. And there is a serious outbreak of Japanese beetle in the Midwest this year. And I know one of the things that our staff has been complaining to the federal government, that things are too lax at some airports in the Midwest, like Indianapolis, where these things can get on, and you can't find all of them. You just cannot catch them all or detect them or treat them when they appear here. So, but we look out for them as best we can, and in this case, fortunately, we think we found them before they got out of hand, and time will tell. But Our staff does an amazing job. You know, I'm in awe of these people every time I learn about something they've done to get the cooperation of all the entities at Portland Airport, as well as the landowners in this industrial residential neighborhood south of the airport, and get this done in time for it to matter. It's amazing, but they did it.
It sounds like we need a federal fix that would apply to all airports equally. My other question is, apparently, must have been the Department of Ag. We have been going in and treating certain lakes and streams for non-indigenous aquatic species. And a year or so ago, I received a complaint that a particular lake was kind of put on hold because you were writing rules and maybe changing how you were doing things. They were very concerned because they had a 3-year plan, and I think they were 1 or 2 years into the plan, and all of a sudden they had to wait a year, and they were concerned about losing the value of everything they'd put into the plan. I talked with Mark Sitzma at the time, and he seemed to think we'd come out okay, but are the rules written? Are we moving? I mean, this is for application of stuff. I don't know. I mean, it's not an herbicide as such, I don't think. But
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I don't know specifically about the issue you're referring to.
It's the city of Rockaway Beach and Lake Lytle.
I would have to check into it and get back
okay.
to you.
When things change, I understand we have to react to things changing, and so if there was a federal requirement change or something changed that we had to go in and take another look at what we were doing, I understand that. I'm just hoping that we're beyond that.
I think that the use of aquatic pesticides is a particularly sensitive issue, and it may be that there's some holdup in getting approval for that. I just wanted to relate to a case to you right now that we're dealing with. There is a gypsy moth infestation that has now encompassed about 700 acres in southeast Lincoln County near the town of Fisher. We are going to have to get what is called an NPDES permit in order to conduct that eradication operation, because the Forest Service lost a case in the Ninth Circuit Court recently spraying for a moth in eastern Oregon, and they were sued, and the plaintiffs argued that the aerial spraying of the pesticide was a point source, and they needed an NPDES permit to conduct this operation. So complications in the use of pesticides come up all the time, and I don't know about the specific case that you're referring to, but it would not surprise me at all if there's been, you know, the necessity for some sort of environmental impact work that's taken a long time. But we'll find out, and we'll get back to you.
I know, Senator, Ten Mile Lakes has got a huge weed problem. There's just not a lot of money available at DEQ or anything.
Well, the city ended up money. Put $5,000 in that little city, and they were moving along, and they got a couple of years done, and then had to stop.
Representative Martin.
Chuck, with that issue with the gypsy moth and needing to get an NPDES permit before you can apply the pesticide, what kind of time frame is that going to add to it?
We're rushing. You know, if it weren't for the good cooperation that we're getting from our colleagues at DEQ, I don't think we'd make it, but they're doing everything they can to help us get through the process and get the permit within the period of time. As I recall, we need to spray in April. The agent that's used is BT, and it kills caterpillars when they're eating leaves, and you have to get the pest when it's in that stage with that particular compound, and it's one of the preferred ones for us to use because it's so innocuous environmentally. But there's a 2 or 3 week window of time that you have to do it. And there are, you know, a lot of issues involved in getting the permit that you have to work through. Some of them even involve proprietary information from the company being unwilling to divulge what the inert ingredients may be in the product, and then us not being able to complete the environmental impact process because of not having that information. But we, you know, every time we bump into one of these obstacles, we try to find a way around it, and so far everybody at the state level is cooperating and trying to get this done. So,
well, Mr. Chair, sure. The BT has been used, I can think of several instances in the past where federal agencies have used it on infestations. When did this court case come out?
This was last year, as I recall. And it's a fairly recent decision. The lawsuit was against the Forest Service. And it was a tussock moth or something like that in eastern Oregon, that they were conducting a project to eradicate that, and they were sued and they lost in the Ninth Circuit. What the Board of Agriculture did, and what a number of industry interests in Oregon have done, have communicated to the U.S. Attorney and asked the U.S. Attorney General to ask for a new hearing on the case. And they have done that. I don't know what the outcome is on that, when it will take place, and so on.
But if I might have one more follow-up.
One more.
But the pragmatic impact from the point of view of controlling is that now there is an NPDES process that has to be inserted into mm-hmm. the... That's like a year.
Normally, you're talking about months and tens of thousands of dollars in cost. How much you can simplify it through the use of general permits and permits that cover, you know, the agency to conduct a class of operations instead of just one specifically, is yet to be learned. I mean, of course, we're hoping that the courts will reverse themselves on this, so that we don't have to have this sort of burden every time we deal with an invasive species. But the issue wasn't over so much the toxicity of BT as it was the point of the suit had to do with the Clean Water Act and whether this was a point source or not. So.
Lieutenant Krieger?
Thank you, Chair. I want to make sure, Chuck, we go back and talk about the subject that you and I talked about, predators as far as bear. I just got the 2000 bear study overflight in the Department of Forestry. It was 246,000 trees damaged or killed, and that was only in the flight area. Coos Curry, part of Douglas wasn't even counted. It could be double that. At $100 a tree, that's somewhere around $24 million, $25 million a year, just in the area they surveyed. Senator Dukes, part of your state forest ground in Clatsop County has got 40% kill in areas that have been thinned. It's going to affect your schools and your county roads. It does all over. I think we need to be aware that this is probably a much greater effect in Oregon than we realize.
Okay, proceed, Chuck.
Mr. Chair, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, now we'd like to move into the food safety policy area. There are four divisions in that policy area. Obviously, we will not get through all of them today, but perhaps we can get through one and then finish the rest tomorrow. And making the presentation to you today is Lisa Hansen, who is Assistant Director for Food Safety and Consumer Protection areas of the agency.
And I'm hopeful we can do it all.
Well, we might.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen with the Department of Agriculture. I'm going to start out by talking about the Food Safety Division. This division is funded about 77% other funds, which are licensing fees primarily, and 23% general fund. The purpose of this division is to license and inspect all facets of the food distribution system except restaurants. There are nearly 10,000 licensees that are subject to this program. The division also assists in educating consumers and companies about overall food quality and food safety concerns. There are three primary programs in this division. The food and meat program, which provides sanitation inspection, equipment testing, and product grading monitoring. This is done in retail establishments, food processors, non-alcoholic beverage plants, domestic kitchens, custom mobile slaughters, and custom meat packers. The dairy program. This program assures a safe and wholesome milk and dairy product supply, as well as assuring that Oregon milk products can be shipped interstate. And then finally, the shellfish program. This program monitors the shellfish growing areas in Oregon and inspects shellfish dealers. This program, again, has an economic development component to it in that it allows our shellfish that's produced commercially to be shipped interstate. There are about 43 FTE in the Food Safety Division, and again, $1.9 million in general fund and $6.7 million in other funds. The division has had several major accomplishments during the current biennium. One of the largest accomplishments is the adoption of the FDA Food Code. This was it took effect on January 1st of 2003. This is a complete change in how the program inspects licensees. It looks at specific issues that relate to foodborne illness, and it addresses the 10 scientifically based risk factors identified by CDC as the most likely to cause foodborne illness. In the dairy program, 1,100 inspections were completed during the biennium. We had one operation that was out of compliance during the five-year period, and this resulted in that operation not selling product for a period of 3 to 4 days. They shut down, they corrected the problem, and then were able to start up shipment again. This program also works in conjunction with FDA and performs FDA contract inspections of food processors. Over the last several years, we've seen a steady increase in the number of contract inspections that the division is performing. We anticipate that that's going to stop at about 750 contract inspections per year. This work is important because it eliminates duplication of effort, and it also mitigates some of the burden on the licensees of having multiple inspections of their facilities. And just a little bit of information about complaints that this division receives. The division will receive complaints from consumers about food products and food handling practices. These have ranged from 327 in 2000 to 426 in 2002. And a typical complaint could be something to the effect of the person had became ill after eating a certain food product, or it could be as minor as I saw somebody handling money and then handling food products. When these complaints come into the division, they're ranked to determine if they're a high risk, a medium risk, or a low risk, and then they're addressed accordingly within that program. And that's the Food Safety Division. I remember Senator Dukes, I think, had a question about the shellfish program.
Let's open for questions. Yes, Senator Dukes. Do you have a question on the shellfish?
Oh, it's, and maybe this isn't the time for it, some very specific questions on funding and funding shortages that I'm now hearing exist in the commercial program, as well as funding shortages that I know exist in the non-commercial program. And I don't mean to take up everybody's time. I just need to get it sorted out and you know how we're dealing with it or whether we're dealing with it. I guess you deal with it one way or another. You shut them down or you fund it. I don't know that everybody else wants to know that. But
I think, Senator, whether we take the time now, but I would like that information for the whole committee because there simply won't be a market if they are not expected to
fish
oysters. That's very, very important. Representative Morgan and Representative Johnson.
A question about the frequency of inspections. How is that set?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the frequency of inspection depends on the type of facility and if it's regulated by FDA. For instance, on the Interstate Milk Shippers Conference, which would be in our dairy program to allow Oregon milk products to ship interstate, FDA sets that frequency. It's a program that is regulated by FDA. The same would be true of the shellfish program. That's a program that's regulated by FDA. Within the food program, the frequency of inspection is dependent on the type of inspections and the types of facilities. And so those, I believe, would be in statute, and I could get more information on that if you would like.
Where I was trying to go with this is most of this is other funds, but there is about a quarter of it that's general fund. Is there potential to save any general fund by changing the timing on the inspections, by changing the how much time lapses between them?
Representative Morgan, members of the committee, that's a question I would need to go back and talk with our division administrator about a little bit more to get some more specifics in terms of the timing. And I would be happy to bring that information back to you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and committee, during the special sessions we all lived through, there was places in our budget where we had fee shifts, and this was one of those areas where we shifted some of the program that had been supported with general fund over to other funds. And I don't know, Lisa, if you know offhand what that means in terms of the necessity for a fee increase, how far in the future. But we did do a little bit of that during the special sessions.
Members of the committee, during the special session, prior to the second special session, I believe, the program was funded 80%, or 70% general fund, 30%. 70% other fund, 30% general fund. And then we did a fund shift, which moved it to almost 80% other funds, 20% general fund. We anticipated that we could go 3 to 5 years before we would need to raise fees in this program.
But has the... I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. So is what's happening then is because you shifted the general fund out and it decreased the amount of the percentage that was general fund, does that mean that your fee increase lasts a shorter time before you run out of money?
Members of the committee, that is correct. This program saw a significant increase in revenues coming into it during the 90s, during the boom in businesses, because it's driven by the licenses. And so we are able to live on that fund balance for a period of time. But by doing the fund shift, we will have to increase fees sooner than we would have if we would have left it with the 70-30 split.
If I might, Mr. Chair, it may be interesting to explore the frequency of the inspections then to see if we can squeak anything out of this.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question has largely been satisfied by the exchange that has just occurred here. But given the magnitude of the problem that we have in 0305, the paper that you're presenting to all of us about the frequency and the other inspection issues, could you also, in that paper or summary, speculate on what might happen if there is no general fund money for these inspections? Because I think the new governor's charge to the department and Ms. Koba is the linkage between economic development and agriculture, and it certainly seems that if the chair's comment about the possibility of shutting down the industry might be an outcome of no inspection, that certainly flies in the face of the goal set out by the new governor for the department. And I'm just trying to get a sense how nimbly the department could manage were there no general fund to do this kind of activity.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we'll be happy to address that in the report back to you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I might add, in defense of the industry, and I'm trying to shake the cobwebs off my head from when I was at the department before, I know that there's strong feelings in the industry that there should be a general fund component to this kind of program because it is consumer protection, and you may be hearing from members of that industry if they have concerns about moving general fund out.
Respectfully, Ms. Coburn, you know this better than anybody at that table. I think every segment has strong feelings about the necessity to prop up program with general fund. I'm just trying to look towards what may be an inexorable reality. We've got a hole that starts with billions, and my concern is, and I'm asking agencies that I have occasion to see budgets on, what would you do if there is no general fund option in order to keep, in this case, an industry alive?
Representative Morgan.
I would concur with Representative Johnson's comments that, if we're going to base our funding criteria on public outcry if we make the cuts, there's going to be an awful long line forming on the left here, and we're going to be
yes, right.
For the and the right. I don't want to malign the left.
So we're not going to make our 3:00 deadline. So.
Oh, sorry.
I have a question. I apologize. I'm confused, and you can straighten me out some other time if that's the best way to do it. But I see that in the budget, you're requesting 2 new FTE in the food safety thing, and one of the things they're going to work on is shellfish inspection. I've been working under the belief that you were short of staff and that program was imploding. So help me understand.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I believe the request for the 2 new FTE is to meet the requirements and the demands of taking on the additional FDA contract inspections.
Not
shellfish, that's correct.
Okay, well, back here where it talks about the budget and the new people, and then it says expected results of the 2003-05 budget. One of the expected results is expand the shellfish program to provide complete monitoring of shellfish harvesting areas in bays that are not shipping interstate. You got money to do that? Cause I got a bill I just dropped today that I may try to recall if we're...
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, the shellfish program historically has not had adequate funding to cover the cost of the program. Our department has been working with the industry to try and find additional efficiencies to bring the program within the budget that it's been provided. We have consolidated our laboratory services division, made cost savings in there, and we're also working with the industry to find areas where we can use the industry to help us meet some of the requirements.
Right. Well, this isn't just industry.
The interstate shellfish program.
I mean, this. What they're talking about here is not just commercial. This is non-commercial as well, so that's why I'm wondering. Maybe I'm mistaken, and you're fine financially.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, you are correct in that there is a shortfall in the shellfish program for covering the cost of the shellfish program.
Then how do you have as a goal that you're going to expand the shellfish program to provide complete monitoring of shellfish harvesting areas in bays that are not shipping interstate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I need to go back and talk with my division administrator about what he was addressing in that item.
You, Lisa, you mentioned that you were increasing 2 FTE to cover the FDA inspections. Will that be covered with federal funds then?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. The FDA contracts will be covered with revenues from FDA.
And that's totally... question that issue, as I know many times we require responsibilities from DEQ or other departments and did not get the funds to deliver. Now, that's some of that's history, I know. I think in these times especially, we want to make adequately sure, not only for presently, but for the cost ramp up in the future as well. Chief.
The next division in the food safety program area is the measurement standards division. This division touches every consumer in Oregon in some way. This division is primarily other funds, only a little less than 1% in this division is general funded. This division is involved in almost every consumer transaction, and to ensure that the business environment is fair for both the consumer and the retailer. There are four basic programs within the division. Weights and measures. This program checks weighing and measuring devices used in Oregon commerce. And the motor fuel quality program. This program conducts fuel octane screenings, and it collects samples to test for water in storage tanks and investigates motor fuel complaints. We have a metrology lab which calibrates standards of length, volume, and mass, and we also maintain and secure the state's primary standards for mass, volume, temperature, and length. And the final program is transaction verification, and this includes the packaged products inspection program as well as a program that does test purchases of bulk products and motor fuel to assure that people are getting what they're paying for. There's only $30,000 left in this program in general fund. This is as a result of special session reductions. The general fund previously went to fund the packaged products program. This is an interesting graph, I believe. This division licenses more than 51,000 weighing and measuring devices. And the graph shows the correlation between the increase in population in Oregon and the number of licensed devices. Our division has one of only seven laboratories that's recognized nationally for performing testing of large capacity scales. This is through the NTEP program, and this assures that new devices are inspected prior to going into the chain of commerce. In addition, the high-tech industries use our laboratory to calibrate standards that are used for weighing and measuring, and we certify balls for the lottery to assure that they're equal size and mass. During the most recent biennium, the packaged products program had ramped up and was starting to do more work. This graph illustrates some of the work and the challenge that we have or had. With assuming a 90% level of all packages meeting their net content statements, with the audits that were conducted during 2002, this shows that we're significantly under that for products that are sold in Oregon. Whether they are stored and packed here or brought in from out of state. And so this just shows the effort that's necessary in bringing those people along through education and outreach. But again, this program has been defunded due to the special sessions.
Well, let me ask you a question. I know in livestock scales, they are checked not only by the state but also by the Tucker's Duck area. Are there other areas where there is a federal test as well as a state test? And I know at one point I've been involved where there was a problem where they were inspected like a month apart as opposed to spreading it out so that they could enhance each other's programs. Is that an issue that is dealt with other than the livestock scale?
Mr. Chair, I'll have to check on the livestock scale question. But what I can tell you is we have been working within the division to look at the frequency of inspection by looking at the inspection results and trying to focus our efforts on those areas where there are problems.
Any more?
I want to talk about the lab that tests the scales.
Mm-hmm.
Does it only test new scales?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the NTEP program specifically is targeted at new scales. Our laboratory tests scales that are in use. We do work, fee-for-service work for other entities, so these could be old scales that are in commerce currently.
With the NTEP program, is that a fee-for-service program?
Any of the work that is done in our laboratory would be fee-for-service.
So there's no potential for general fund savings by changing practices?
This division, programs in this division, are almost entirely other-funded, with the exception of the $30,000 for the packaged products program.
Mr. Chairman, we've got about 10 minutes left. The pesticides division, I'm guessing there might be a lot of interest in. I don't know if we can actually get through it in 10 minutes, or we can start and see how far we make it.
Let's go as far as we can. You've actually got 4 minutes.
The pesticides division is funded through three sources: general funds, federal funds, and largely through other funds, which would be licenses and registration fees for both pesticide products and fertilizer products. This division seeks to protect people and the environment from the adverse effects of pesticides and fertilizers while maintaining their availability for beneficial uses. There are three main programs in the pesticides division. What we refer to as the base pesticide program. This program regulates the distribution of pesticide products, licenses and certifies pesticide applicators, and investigates incidents of alleged pesticide misuse. Our fertilizer program, which was reinvigorated as a result of legislation passed last session, regulates the distribution of fertilizer products sold in Oregon. And finally, the pesticide use reporting system, which is charged with collecting and storing, organizing and reporting all aspects of pesticide use in the state. The federal funds in this program primarily come from US EPA, and the approximately $600,000 in general funds that are in the division are dedicated to the pesticide use reporting system. The pesticides division registered almost 10,000 products for use in Oregon in 202. It licensed more than 11,600 commercial and public pesticide applicators and conducted 402 compliance investigations. This graph shows some of the trends in our investigations and our enforcement actions. And you'll note that our enforcement actions are much lower than the number of investigations that we typically would conduct. The fertilizer program, as I said, was enhanced as a result of last session. It did several things for the state of Oregon. It established limits for 5 heavy metals. In addition, we've set up a website with fertilizer product information that's available to the public. This program also established investigational and sampling and testing allowances, and there's a new fertilizer advisory committee that will assist the department in designing and evaluating fertilizer research projects. Oregon is one of 5 states that now has limits set for heavy metals in fertilizer products. And finally, the pesticide use reporting system. During the most recent biennium, the department developed and implemented the temporary pesticide use reporting system and is close to completing the permanent system, but has been put on a pause mode with that due to the lack of funding. And we have also conducted a pilot program to capture household use information during 202, and the full survey is underway for 203.
questions from the committee?
Let's see, Katie.
Still moving.
Jinx.
We're still going.
This division is one that a lot of people will have interest in.
Mr. Chair, I do have a question. I'm sorry to ruin the rhythm. The three-month pilot to capture pesticide use information by households, what was the point of data collection?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that actually was a statewide survey for the 3 months. Our contractor who's working with us on collecting the data held 4 focus groups around the state to learn how to ask the questions, and then did the pilot program to validate that we could collect information the way we had anticipated across the state.
So will there be a mix of both urban and rural ability to capture this household information?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, that's correct. There will be a cross of urban and rural. It affects all households.
Okay. One more, Mr.
Yeah,
Chairman.
Well, I can tell.
I'm sorry. Developed and implemented a temporary system for pesticide users to report pesticide use. Nearly completed the development of the permanent system. Well, that's great, but the nearly completed piece is problematic, and I didn't sit on this committee last time, but just from being around here, I understand there's somewhere in the range of 150,000, 175,000 to complete that. Is that number roughly correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, we believe that the cost to complete the system is about $250,000.
$250,000, be that as it may. My question is, absent the expenditure of that $250,000, what do we have left out of the money that's been expended that's usable?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, the temporary system, which is basically an electronic file cabinet, is up and running, and it's being supported with the funds that were made available. There are components of the permanent system that are complete, but it is not functional to capture, hold, analyze, and sort the data that's necessary to meet the requirements of the law.
Mr. Chair, may I put a finer point on this? Maybe you'd report back to the committee, and I'm not asking you to go back and do voluminous research, just a little summary. Because while I may have the numbers slightly incorrect, I think we've spent about $500,000. Close?
A little more.
Okay. We've spent more than $500,000. We're within $250,000 more or less of getting something. I don't even know at this point what we're buying. I don't know the efficacy of what's left if we don't spend $250,000 more. I'm trying to figure out just where are we. And if we've got a system that sort of kind of works or is voluntary, I don't know what we have for all the money we've spent, and have we crossed the Rubicon as far as just abandoning $500,000 more than that expenditure if we don't go the rest of the way? And I guess the larger question one would ask is, how did we get into this situation? We got more than $500,000 of written checks. We're this far from the finish line, may or may not be able to get the rest of the way. Could you give us a little summary about where we are, what we got, what the expectations are?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I will be happy to put a summary together for the committee.
That'd be great. Thank you.
I think that's a great question, and if you could also bring us the amount of what's left can be funded by the dedicated funds and what we have left in general funds. I think the underlying question you're asking is, how much general fund do we have left maybe to help us out of this 0103 crisis we're into? That's the question I have.
How much general fund can be pulled out now to help plug the 0103 hole?
Yeah, if there's leftover general funds.
Well, and I'm trying to get a sense that if you did pull that out, have we just gone down and thrown more than $500,000 in the river? What do we have left at the end of the day?
Good question. Thank you.
The final division in the food safety policy area is the Commodity Inspection Division. This division is funded entirely by other funds. Those are generated from fees for service and licenses. The Commodity Inspection Division assists growers in the industry in facilitating transactions between buyers and sellers so that Oregon commodities meet the requirements of the domestic and international markets. This is done through third-party inspection, grading, verification, and certifications. There are four main programs in this division. The largest program is the Shipping Point Inspection Program. This program inspects and certifies fresh fruits and vegetables for the domestic and international market. The Seed and Produce Program. The Seed Program consists of the seed sampling and testing program, as well as the seed regulatory program. The seed regulatory program was initiated sometime in the early 90s at the request of the seed industry to provide a fair playing field. And as a result, Oregon's grass seed has a very strong quality reputation worldwide. Our produce regulatory program is simply a licensing and bonding program for produce dealers. The hop and hay program provides sampling, testing, and certification. The largest component of this program is the certification of grass seed straw for export. And that's the market that was developed as a result of the limitation on field burning some years ago. And the final program in this division is the grains program, and that's the licensing and bonding of Oregon grain warehouses. As you may note, this division has many positions. Most of them are seasonal. The work is largely conducted by 70 permanent employees that are strategically stationed around the state in agricultural growing areas that provide on-the-ground certification for agricultural commodities. And the largest facet of our program in the shipping point is the inspection of potatoes for processing. This program inspected 2.7 billion pounds of produce for processing last year and 1.4 billion pounds of fresh fruits and vegetables. In addition, this division has seen some changes in the way services are required, and one of those changes was a need to control the cost of providing the services to the industry. So several new programs have been initiated, and one of those is the Customer Assisted Inspection Program. It's more audit-based. It reduces the cost of inspection to the industry, and it also reduces the labor costs for the state. Additionally, several new programs were initiated during the current biennium. The industry had requested that the department provide services for good agricultural and good handling practices certifications to facilitate moving products into the market and meeting retail requirements. ODA, in conjunction with several states and USDA, developed a federal-state program, and Oregon had the first produce packer that was certified under these standards. Additionally, there are several new voluntary programs that have been initiated. One was a pilot program for identity preservation for one of the food processors, and some of our potato packers are requesting services for securing storage, and this is in response to Homeland Security, and it is bringing them additional revenues as a return. This is just an example of one of the certification certificates for the good handling practices.
Very good. We made it.
Mr. Chair, would you entertain? Go back to the last slide for just a second. Senator Dukes and I have the opportunity to shop at a wonderful public market in Astoria, and you can buy produce there that's just drop-dead wonderful produce. I have yet to see one of these good handling practice certificates, and if, in fact, if I understood you correctly, this is a voluntary program, how well do farmers markets and the people that are now that interface in what I see is a growing industry where you've got organic produce being presented locally, How widely is disseminated the information that you can have one of these good handling verifications if you go through the process? I mean, if it's valuable, why don't the wonderful guys that sell potatoes at our terrific little farmer's market think it has enough value to go get one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, this program started in response to many of the retailers' concerns on minimizing the potential for microbial contamination in fresh fruits and vegetables. And those were guidelines that were set forth by FDA several years ago. It provides a third-party audit to meet those needs. It's a very new program. I believe there were less than 60 audits conducted during the last year. So it's just starting to get going. It's a change in the type of inspections that are being required. Traditionally, this division has provided quality certification. You say the potatoes are grade A, we inspect to make sure they're grade A, if that's what it said on the bag. This is a change in what people are beginning to look for and some of the concerns that have come up in the food distribution process.
And Mr. Chair, I might add that probably the target for this program are consumers outside the state of Oregon, particularly the international market, because it's there that we find there's such a strong interest in food safety issues related to food. On the flip side, in terms of farmers markets and those kinds of activities here in Oregon, we're just starting to kind of delve into the notion of Brand Oregon, or Buy Oregon First, some of those kinds of things that we might look at to do here within the state that helps Oregonians identify products that are grown in Oregon, and therefore, you know, they may be more inclined to buy those. So that's something that we're kind of noodling around with to help folks here in the state of Oregon with their Mr. Chairman, I just might leave. I've got the vacancy list that you had requested that I can leave with you, and then some information on complaints that you had asked for as well.
Thank you very much, Lisa. We kind of rushed you along here, but I think you did a great job of getting this information. With that, let me close the public hearing and close the committee meeting.